Ladies and gentlemen, storytellers of all ages, lend your ears to co-hosts Brad and Philip as we delve into the Marketing Your Attraction podcast.
Welcome to Marketing Your Attraction, episode 10. I'm your host, Brad, and I'm here with my wonderful co-host, Philip, who is broadcasting live or recording live from Chicago. How you doing, Philip?
Hello. I'm doing well. I'm in Chicago right now. I just landed earlier today, and I'm here for Light Fair at McCormick Place. So I just kind of got in and got into the apartment and got all ready to dial up Brad. And for this whole week, I'll be manning our Gantam booth at Light Fair. I won't leave until Friday. So if anyone's listening to this and they're in Chicago, hit me up.
That's awesome. I'm jealous. I love Chicago, as I was telling you before the show. Chicago pizza. And that's not the only reason I love Chicago, but it's definitely a big part of it.
I already got a coupon for I went to the Red Line Cafe to get like super intense coffee for our recording session, because I've been up since 4. And they were like, hey, if you come back tomorrow, you can get a $5 like Chicago wood fire pizza. I'm like, what?
Oh, you better do it so I can live vicariously through you for that.
Oh, so excited.
Awesome. Well, shall we jump into the news real quick and get into our main topic?
To the news. So the first news story here I put in is very interesting. It's on Instagram payments. The article that we'll link to is from Marketing Land. And the quote here I pulled is, users can register a debit or credit card through their Instagram profile and set up a security code with it, making it possible to send payments without ever leaving the app, according to TechCrunch. Instagram told TechCrunch it has plans to expand the payment option to items like movie tickets. This is very exciting to me. I think it's a good thing overall. I mean, it's a good thing for us in the attractions, because movie tickets, you know, then it'll be a next logical leap over to tickets, you know, for attractions. So, you know, if it makes it easier to get a ticket, you know, where you're looking at, you know, your parks or your attractions story or some sort of campaign you run on Instagram. And if it's just a easy, you know, kind of, they're watching a really engaging story or an influencer piece from you, and they can just click on your bio to buy tickets, I think that's very promising. I'm also worried at the same time, because whenever Facebook does stuff like this, I just get worried and I'm like, this sounds really good. Is it going to end up being really terrible for us down the road somehow? I'm not sure. What do you think, Brad?
The promising part about the article is that it looks like they're going to integrate with multiple partners. So it's still early on, but it sounds like it won't just be, you know, Instagram payments that you'll be going through, but you might be able to connect up with different reservation systems. The news article from Marketing Land mentions Resy, an online reservation app for restaurants, is one of the first of the limited number of partners and businesses to be trying out this feature. So that's a good sign, because I think what I would fear is what Ticketmaster became in the 90s, where it was the only place where you could go to buy concert tickets and tickets for other events. And that for a long time hampered, you know, independent bands and raised prices for, you know, guests and customers of those bands and other event venues. It's always good to have multiple venues or multiple vendors to purchase tickets through. And I would be I'd be worried if Instagram payments became the de facto way or the only way to buy tickets. And I doubt it would ever be able to become that big, as you have everything from Eventbrite to Apple Payments and all of the other companies out there that you know, have different payment methods for ticketing. But if it makes it easier for the, you know, for our potential guests to be able to buy tickets, that's fantastic. I mean, it's just one less hoop for you know, customers to go through. Because it's tough. If you click on out of an Instagram ad, you're out of that Instagram experience. Now you're on to, you know, a Knott's.com website or whatever attraction you're buying a ticket for. You have to put in your credit card details, or you have to log into your PayPal account. If you have a PayPal account and they integrate with that, it's just extra steps. So the less steps it can take for a guest to give your attraction money, the better. So I'm interested to see where this develops. And I'm glad that at least right now, they're reaching out to multiple partners, and it's not just the Instagram show for that.
Yes. So
we'll have to keep a close eye on this, because like you said, whenever Instagram/Facebook rolls out any feature, I think everyone gets really nervous. I know Facebook this week, it's not really related to the attraction industry, or at least not related to our attraction industry, but the dating industry. You know, Facebook rolled out or announced that they're going to begin rolling out Facebook dating on the Facebook app. And you saw Match.com and all of the other big dating websites out there, their stock just crashed, because then that 800-pound gorilla of Facebook is going to come in. They have all of that data. They already have, you know, over a billion people on your platform. So when they move into these different areas, both competitors and partners get nervous. And like you mentioned, it could go either way. So fingers crossed that this becomes a great tool for attractions and a great way for, you know, guests to be able to purchase tickets quicker and with you know, less irritation. Our next news story comes from...
So it's from the Maui News, and it's simple message and colorful images work best on social media, says expert, is the title. And apparently what happened is there was a two-day Hawaii Small Business Conference in Maui, and there was a social media expert there who runs a company, you know, where she does social media for brands. And the news is writing this article as like kind of a recap of some of the things that she said in her talk. So I read it, and there's just a few things here. Like here's a great, like the opening quote here is, since humans have an attention span of only 8 seconds, even less than goldfish, social media messages, especially from businesses to customers, need to have strong images and clear, simple messages, says a social media advisor on Thursday. So this is wrong. But the main point for us putting this in here for you guys is to just kind of re-underline that, you know, social media has been around not that very long. I mean, sometimes it is hard to figure out if the person that you're hiring is, actually knows what they're doing, you know, and that's kind of why the purpose behind this podcast in the beginning is to give you, even if you are hiring somebody out, you know, or you're working with an agency or partners, you know, it really is a good idea for you as a person who's kind of steering your brand's ship, your attraction's ship, to understand some basic stuff about marketing and social media and all these different spheres, which is kind of why we have this podcast. So, you know, whether you're doing it alone and you're kind of doing everything by yourself, and you're maybe hiring one or two people out, you know, you can definitely hire the wrong people in there. Definitely, just because somebody has a biz, like quote unquote business, that is, you know, a social media advisor or social media that they're running for that doesn't mean they actually know what they're doing. So just kind of putting that out there.
And if they call themselves an expert, most likely they're not. But that's usually a warning sign on it. Not to pick too much on this article either, because I think social media is a really hard thing. You know, like many areas of marketing, really many areas of different industries, it's a hard concept to describe in the local news. And so I'm hoping that some of this was sort of lost in translation from the quote unquote social media expert to the news reporter. But it's just very simplistic. And I think anytime that advice is simple or overly broad, you know, a lot of the information in here, she's trying to apply to all businesses, and there wasn't really much research or anything. And you know, when you say like, oh, well, colorful images work best or simple messages work best. Like there's so many examples where, you know, yes, those do work, but then there's also so many other examples and other brands where they sell tons and tons of stuff by having really comprehensive, you know, white papers and articles that are 10 pages long. They do all sorts of content marketing. And so you can always find examples that are successful for any and every type of creative. But you really have to figure out, has this, you know, quote unquote expert that you're hiring or vendor that you're hiring, have they done work in your industry? Do they understand your brand? And you want to make sure you at least understand social media and marketing and whatever, whatever area you're hiring for, at least past that surface level. So you can't just say, oh, hey, do you know social media? But you have to be able to challenge that vendor on it, or at least bring in a project manager, a producer who can challenge them to make sure you're not being ripped off. And like Philip mentioned, I think it was episode 7 or 8, you did a great episode talking all about how, you outsource and how you can figure out how to bring in partners and vendors who understand areas of expertise that you don't have by making sure you're not going to get ripped off. So that's what I took away from this article.
Yeah. I like it. It also, I think kind of leads into our main topic for today. So our main topic today is influencer marketing. So this is one of those like hot button topics. Definitely, it's become a buzzword, and it's been going on for a while, and it sits definitely in that realm where there are a lot of people who are influence, that are like self-proclaimed influencers, and there's a lot of people that are influencer marketing specialists, and I've heard a lot of terms like brand experience crafter expert, and just a lot of like whole offshoots of this whole thing. So that's our main topic for today, kind of leaping off of this. And so what we're going to do here is we kind of each have a little bit of stories, and then we're going to tie in another news story kind of for some homework or some extra listening for those of you out there. The definition of who is an influencer is getting eroded, because it used to be that influencers were kind of like mainstream media and big personalities and kind of like A-list celebrities. And now we've really gotten down to where there's, quote unquote, micro influencers, which really is a byproduct of the degradation of trust with people. So influencer really is just a people. I would define it, I'm not even sure if there isn't a definition, but I would define it as somebody who has a relationship with an addressable audience, where that addressable audience trusts the person enough to take action on their recommendation. That's kind of how I would define them. And influencer marketing, I guess I would define, is working with an influencer to create content with, or to partner in some way to achieve a marketing goal with your brand.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. I think that's probably one of the best definitions of influencer marketing I've heard, because like you said, it gets very vague. And just to start out, I would say we're not only talking about paid influencer marketing. So I feel like a lot of brands only focus on paying influencers. And I'm sure many of the attractions that our audience owns, including Knott's Berry Farm, which I work at, we don't have the ability to pay influencers all the time, and you don't have to. I'll get into that a little bit later as well. But to set the stage, I look at influencer marketing as the evolution of public relations. You used to pitch the big newspapers, the local news broadcasters out there. And that was, for a long time, that was the media, a few radio stations here and there. Those were the, let's say, 10 to 15 different companies, different reporters that you were pitching every single time you had to do a traction open, every time you were starting your season. That was your strategy. And what's happened over the last few years is probably all of our audience knows is people are not reading the newspaper as much anymore. They're not turning on the local news. They're going on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Snapchat. They're following their friends, but they're also following influencers, people who are either really popular because of their celebrity, or they've been in movies, but more often than not, the influencers we're talking about have built an online presence, a sort of digital news outlet on social media. And so you have old style theme park websites like Mice Chat or ThemeParkInsider.com that have been around for over a decade, have now sort of navigated to social media and have become influencers in their own right. But then you also have a lot of upstarts who have never really had a website presence, and all of their outlet is through these social media sites. And so for some examples that we work with at Knott's Berry Farm, foodbeast.com, we've done a lot of work with. They're a huge food influencer site. I believe they have around 10 full-time employees. They have a huge presence in Southern California, but they also have a national audience too. And they do have a website, but primarily they get the word out through Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, and they have an audience of, you know, millions and millions of people. But on the smaller end, on like a micro influencer end, we work with different mom and dad bloggers, different family bloggers in the area. Some of them may have blogs, so they might be the family bloggers, but then a lot of them, their whole presence is on just on Instagram or just on Snapchat. So there's a lot of different ways to look at it. In the hunt world, an influencer that we worked with just last year is a company called Crypt TV, where they create horror content just for social. So they have a website, but I don't even think they put much of their content on there. It's primarily Facebook is their biggest outlet. So we've done a paid promotion. The only paid promotions we've done in my 4 years at the company, not counting celebrities. We have brought in celebrities to do both paid and non-paid work for us. But just looking at influencers outside of the celebrity world, we have only worked with Food Beast and Crypt TV. I don't think I'm allowed to say how much we paid them, but you know, they weren't huge fees, but they also weren't nominal fees either. And when you're paying an influencer, you're usually able to really work within and craft that content. But it's a lot of work. You know, when I worked with Food Beast, it was probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 different meetings. They have a great team over there. But just trying to figure out, okay, well, what are they offering? What's this, you know, quote unquote native advertising where we're paying them to create content that showcases our brand, but in their voice. And that's a tricky part, right? Because you have your brand's voice. We have the Knott's Berry Farm voice. And then Food Beast has their brand voice, which is very different than ours. But you don't want to work with an influencer who you're not comfortable with their voice, because the content has to be successful, in my opinion. You have to have content that is authentic to their brand voice, to that influencer's voice, while also still being on brand for your voice as well. So for an example of Food Beast, I think we first worked with them a year or two on the editorial side, actually probably 3 years ago. We just had them cover Boysenberry, and that was a non-paid activation as well. And we pitch influencers all the time, and just in the same way that you would pitch reporters. So you go and, you shoot them an email pitch. I try to customize it a lot of the time. Both myself and the team I work with at Knott's Berry Farm. So you can pitch them that way to come to your events, and some of the bigger influencers, instead of inviting them to like a big PR event, we'll do smaller meet and greets with them where I'll just take them through a scary farm maze, or I'll have them come and meet with a chef to try different food items for something like the Boysenberry Festival. So that's an example on the editorial side. When we find content that works like a Food Beast with their influencer marketing that we did with them, just the editorial side, the free side, the non-advertising side, their videos were huge. We saw huge engagement, tons of comments, tons of video views. Saw a lot of people clicking from their content and going to our social media pages. We saw when we would work with them on the editorial side, once again, we have not paid them. In the first couple of years when I worked with them, they would mention an item at the park, a food item, and all of a sudden we would see lines for that item. So once we had that relationship established, we realized like, okay, this is something that works, and we want to take this relationship to the next level with them. And so then that's when we started exploring native advertising with them. And then what that allowed us to do is to create longer pieces that were really focused on Knott's Berry Farm. We were able to have, you know, multiple posts, longer videos, work with their creative team to really figure out how do we show off this food. You know, beforehand, it was very much they would come taste different things. They would kind of pick what they wanted to show, and we didn't have as much of a hand in it. So that's sort of a long, quick example of how we've worked with a couple of influencers, both on the non-paid and the paid side.
I think one of the main elephants is in the room is like, with influencer marketing is knowing what to measure in order to prove the ROI on the campaign. And I say what to measure because I think it's really important to establish like what is the metric that you're going to look at. Sometimes it's not as cut and dry as ticket sales or, you know, food item sales. Yeah, my example is I've done a little bit of influencer work myself. Like I've worked for other people as an influencer. One of my favorite examples is for the Halloween Party Expo and HauntCon. Halloween Party Expo is a retail show that happens every January in New Orleans, and it's a wholesale show. Like Spirit Halloween, those types of stores, everything from big chains down to small mom and pop independent stores go to Halloween Party Expo in January to kind of place wholesale orders for their Halloween stock. That show is owned by a larger, kind of like very large, a trade show company called Clarion Events. That company recently bought HauntCon, which is a pretty old kind of classic haunter show. They did a really good job. They basically, I haven't seen it. I'd really like to. It might be something we could get on the podcast, but they have a really kind of in-depth marketing plan and kind of like a whole strategy for moving over buyers and influencers and everybody kind of over to the show and who to host and that whole thing. It's very impressive. And I worked with Clarion's VP of marketing. Basically, what they wanted me to do last year was me as the influencer, I was supposed to put together the main stage panel that would be for both shows. So any attendees could have access to that panel. It was kind of set in the middle of the show floor so that it would sit between the two shows. And it's marketed as, you know, one of the main featured panels for both shows. So the task was kind of like put together this panel that is in line with our brand and what we are trying to do. They wanted me to also bring on other influencers. So bring in other influencers and other people that would qualify the panel topic and make the panel useful to the attendees and also make it useful to their brand kind of a thing. Then afterwards, they would use that kind of to create lead magnets. So they actually just sent out a campaign like last week where they used like notes from that main panel as a lead magnet to get people subscribed onto their email list. So that was, it was interesting. It was an interesting thing. I'm really glad I got to work with them on that because it's a really good team and they were very flexible with me, you know. They're kind of like, this is what we want to achieve. But just to your point, Brad, it did take like several meetings. Like I don't think they had done anything like this with their haunt side. Cause they're, you know, they're new to the haunt market and they hadn't really done anything. And then we were also trying to figure out, you know, like what do the attendees want? You know, what's going to be useful for them? And then we have to balance like store attendees with haunt attendees so that like there's different target markets here. And, but it was really neat because, you know, they gave me, you know, a budget to bring in other influencers. And they were really very supportive of the whole process. And we met several times to kind of get it straightened out. And then they kind of just left it up to me. They're just like, okay, you know, got it figured out. Now, like you take it and create the actual, you know, once we have the direction, then it was my job to create the rest of the panel and write the introduction and ultimately pick who's going to be on it. So it was a very interesting experience. They told me it worked really well and they enjoyed it. And that all the attendees liked it. And it was, I guess, one of the things they really enjoyed about it. I'd be really interested to have a longer conversation with them to see like how they were measuring it besides just, you know, who showed up and their feedback. because essentially what they were trying to do is say, bring an influencer to create like an activation that would be something that people want to attend. You know, like it was one of those things where it didn't directly lead to ticket sales because it was really more of an activity, but it was also supposed to shine their light, kind of make their brand seem like they were innovative, right? Like you know, and then also bring in other influencers and other potential buyers to the show. So it was like a bunch of objectives, you know, that we were trying to like roll into one thing. I guess it ended up going really well, and they've asked me to do it again. So they probably wouldn't have asked me if it didn't go well.
No, that's fascinating to see it from the other side, because I've always seen it from, you know, the marketer side, never from the influencer side. I think both of our examples show how many different ways there are to work with influencers. And it's always a struggle with influencer marketing, because there's some ways you can track it, there's some ways you can't. I'll give a couple of examples of what we've looked at when we've done influencer marketing. So for a lot of the family bloggers, we've implemented a program over the last year or two called our Berry Bloggers program, where we've established relationships. These are non-paid relationships, but relationships with some of our favorite bloggers who were already talking about Knott's Berry Farm before we sort of brought them into the fold as a berry blogger. So very authentic voices. Some have huge audiences, some don't, but they all create great content and they have unique perspectives. For example, you know, some of them are moms or dads with kids who they bring to the park. We have a single dad perspective. We have a grandparents. We have a teenager who loves Scary Farm. We have parents with all different sorts of ages of kids. So everyone from, you know, like 3 and 4 year olds who really enjoy our Camp Snoopy experience to older kids who they go on roller coasters with. So we were really looking at, you know, good content first that we can reshare on our blog and also on our social media platforms, and also a true affinity for the brand. So when we were first creating those programs, those were the first two we were looking at. And then as we started building the program, we wanted to figure out, okay, well, what is this getting us? Yeah. Step one was good. We're getting great content, which enables us to share more content with our fans. And so we've reshared their content, not only on our social media platforms, but also on our website and through a lot of our marketing emails that we do. But we started asking the bloggers to incorporate Google Analytic codes inside their links. Mm-hmm. So whenever they're promoting, you know, our product or promoting our event, we can track that when they go to knotts.com with the special link, we can go into Google Analytics and we can track exactly how much revenue is being driven by each piece of content by each specific blogger. And so then we were able to have a direct return on investment. We were able to show revenue. And we were really pleasantly surprised by how much, you know, revenue these bloggers were generating from their readers. And some of them were generating it through social media. Some of them were generating a lot more through their blog, either from their direct blog audience or from search engines, from, you know, users using search engines and stumbling across their content. So that's a great way to measure revenue. And it doesn't cost anything extra. If you have Google Analytics, you can use your UTM link and just set up your tracking link in there, and you can track it all the way through. It's not 100% perfect, so you can't take, you're not going to track every single piece of revenue that's going through there, but you'll at least directionally have a really good idea of what influencers are working and what influencers are not. Now, not every influencer is going to allow you to get that data. Many are very protective of that. Mm-hmm. And so what we've looked at for more of those bigger influencers, like a Food Beast, or other outlets, is we pay attention to engagement. So we're looking at not only video views, but what are the comments, and digging into, and this might sound a little ridiculous because I think a lot of people like to try to automate analytics, automate tracking, and it's important to do a lot of that. But with influencer marketing in particular, I feel like you have to take the time to evaluate whether the comments and the shares and the engagement that they're getting on their content is actually authentic. So we'll look at, okay, is this person's profile a real person? And there are tools you can automate some of this, but looking at their comments, like, what are the comments saying? Are they actually talking about the brand? Are they talking about what's going on in the video? Or is it just, oh, hey, cool. or, you know, generic viral, you know, comment here. And so usually once you get the hang of it and you look at these comments, you can quickly figure out what is automated and what is real. And the New York Times had a great expose. I think it was January of this year. The article is called The Follower Factory. The summary of it is inside social media's black market. Celebrities, athletes, and politicians are buying millions of fake followers while social media companies struggle to respond. This article was incredible. It finally shined light on what's been going on for a very, very long time, is how these whether it's a celebrity or someone who just wants to become an influencer, is able to go through these different companies that use social media bots and can quickly buy a million followers in a matter of, you know, a day or two, sometimes even less, sometimes in a matter of hours. And this is something that I've been preaching for years and years and years, both to my coworkers, to our ad agencies that we work with, to influencers that approach us with clearly fake audiences. And it's a huge problem in this industry. So I would caution everyone that's listening, as you're looking into influencer marketing, take the time to evaluate whether the audience and the engagement is real. Don't just look at the Twitter followers or the Instagram followers and go, oh my gosh, they have 50,000, 2 million followers. Look at that engagement. You know, click on a post. See, are they actually getting likes? Are there comments? You know, if they're, for example, a really great way to show, or a great way to realize, right? A really great way to realize whether a influencer has fake followers, without using any automated tool or anything, just go to their profile. If you see them with 10,000 followers and you look at an Instagram or Twitter post and they have no likes, no retweets, or they have a ton of likes and retweets, but then very little comments, or the comments are very, you know, like hi or wow, this is cool. There's just not a lot of substance to them. 99% of the time, that person has fake following. And if you're working with them, especially if you're paying an influencer, you have to be really careful about this, because you can be paying hundreds or thousands of dollars to reach a completely fake audience. There's so much fraud in influencer marketing. And that's what's sometimes frustrating. That's what I always remind myself and my team, is don't be impressed by the shiny numbers. And as Philip mentioned in the introduction, you want to make sure that the influencers you're working with match your brand. And even if they don't have a huge amount of followers, if they're, you know, micro followers, as Philip mentioned, that can sometimes be better. I'd rather work with an outlet that has, you know, 10% as many followers, you know, even a few thousand followers, if they're really engaged. A great outlet that is a great example of this is Parks and Cons, which is one of the outlets that we work with at Knott's Berry Farm. They have an audience that is really engaged. It's not as big as certain newspapers or some of the bigger theme park and convention industry outlets out there and influencers, but they have a real audience. They do great content, and you see real comments, real interactions happening on their content. I would say if I had to put a percentage on it, out of the number of influencers we look at and the number of media outlets that request for tickets or request to be invited to an event, probably a good 50% of them have fake followers. And it's everyone from, you know, huge, you know, outlets to even just family bloggers. So I'm always amazed at just how broad the buying fake followers is in the industry. Have you seen that at all, Philip?
Yeah. I've seen it. I've seen it on like a few cycles, you know, just, like I've had people approach me to, like, you know, because we have the network to like to buy followers. So I've like, I've had people be like, oh, you know, we're a firm and we specialize in getting you extra blah, 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 whatever engagement. And it's clearly just them like buying followers. So I've had it on that end. There's been people that have kind of like approached us, like the network, to do like a kind of like content partnerships with, that you can tell are just not, are just kind of like fake people. And then when I was doing some work for Scarolet and for even last year's symposium, actually, we had like people apply that were just not really, yeah, I mean, you typically you can do some poking around and you can tell, pretty easily, you know, and it is getting more difficult because there's, like, there's just so much crud out there in terms of like so many just fake accounts and bots and stuff that just all out there. So it's hard. You really do have to dig into what the community is actually saying, like look at the correspondence between them. And on the flip side, there could be, you know, we've seen a few, there's a few in the haunt industry that are like they don't have that many. So it's like, it's one of those things where like they might have an engaged community, but it's like, you know, 15, 20 people that are the only people engaging kind of a thing. And you're like, well, you know, that's really small, you know, and yeah. Plus kind of like the level of content they're going to create too, you know, but
yeah, it really depends on what you're looking for, because we've worked with smaller, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, we worked with smaller influencers who might not necessarily have a huge audience, but they create great content, whether they're a great writer, great photographer, great videographer. And if you're mm-hmm. then able to share that with your much bigger audience, I wouldn't necessarily maybe pay them for that content, but if they're willing to come to your attraction for just some free tickets and you can work out an arrangement where, hey, you know what? We'll help you build your audience if you help us with content. That can be a great relationship depending on what your needs are as an attraction. And you know, we've looked at that at Knott's too, of, you know, sometimes you bring in an influencer for their audience and for that engaged audience. And sometimes you work with them because they make great content. Yeah. Of course, the best influencer is one who has a huge audience and also creates great content. And most of the biggest influencers, you know, do both out there. But don't, you know, don't feel discouraged by the fraud. I would just say, you know, make sure you know what you're getting into, especially if you're paying influencers. You know, if you're just giving away free tickets, you know, the fraud's not, in my opinion, as big of a deal. Although I do try to make sure we're not giving free tickets to anyone who has fraudulent followings out there. But especially when you're looking at doing that paid native advertising with an influencer, spend the time to do your due diligence and really see what type of metrics they'll give you. But just go on their profile and just see what is their audience talking about. Do they even have any type of engagement, any type of conversation going on at all?
Yeah. Yeah. And the two last things before we wrap up here. Sure. One is just to kind of make sure, and I was trying to pull up an example. So one is, but the other thing is just, when you are doing your vetting, just understand that influencers typically are just kind of, their community is just on one platform. So just kind of keep that in mind. You know, some of them, obviously, you know, you have a website and you have presences on different platforms, but like really typically, unless they're like a really awesome influencer or they're really large, they, if they're on the smaller end, they're probably only going to have an engaged community on one platform. And so it's important to know that, right? Because if you're like, you know, it goes back to the why thing. You know, if you're trying to create something and really the focus is to engage, you know, your Facebook audience or your Instagram or whatever, you're going to have to find someone that actually is versed at that particular platform. Like in addition to being the type of influencer that you want, because they're not typically versed on everything. An example of this is the Homicidal Homemaker, who is local to California, and Casey. And I like Casey, you know, I actually know her in person, you know, and so that's kind of why I would like trust her to do stuff, because I know, and she does boosts, and you know, I know that she has fans. But if you're like just vetting based on her Facebook page, you're like, oh look, you know, she posted zombie, she's posted like zombie peeps, you know, that she made, like how to make zombie peeps, you know, it's for Easter. And you're like, okay, well, it has like 53 shares, you know, or it has 53 likes and 2 shares and only like 3 comments, you know, and they're just kind of not really good comments. So, but that's because her audience like lives on YouTube, because she specializes in video and like long form video, you know, not like Snackable video, not like, you know, it, they're really, it's like a cooking show. So its platform is really YouTube. So just, you know, kind of keep those things in mind when you're doing your vetting, and also when you're trying to figure out the influencer. You know, they usually only have one specialty, and that's the, just the one thing is they'll tell you they have multiple, or they'll tell you sometimes they will tell you, yeah, I can do it for whatever. But you know, they really can't.
Right. Like, yeah.
You know, we should know that as marketers to only put them in the thing.
Yeah. That's great. That's great advice. That. Do you use any tools to find influencers?
Yeah. So I wanted to, bring up BuzzSumo has gone through a lot of iterations, but it's still one of my favorite for searching influencers and also for doing a lot of analysis. It's all paid now. It used to be where you could do like X amount of search, free searches for free, but it's paid now. But I would definitely try out the free trial and see kind of just see who's out there. You might be surprised. I've actually used BuzzSumo quite a few times to success. Like I found some YouTube or not Instagram people that I just messaged through Instagram. Then we put together some cool partnerships with on the network just through, you know, I wouldn't have found them if it weren't for BuzzSumo. Cause like, I don't like really run around and search Instagram all day, you know, but it was good to search it from here.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've looked at a couple of the tools, but we've never used any of the influencer search tools at Knots. Part of that is because there's so many out there, and mm-hmm. I get emails from their salespeople all the time. Not necessarily BuzzSumo, but every day I feel like another influencer agency or influencer search tools out there.
Yep.
But is BuzzSumo, you just find the influencer and then you work directly with the influencer, or are they sort of like,
basically,
so they're not the middleman or middle company?
No. So okay. BuzzSumo is, and I actually used this last year when we did the symposium at Knots to search for influencers that talked about Knots as one of their main topics.
Nice.
So basically, when you search, you can do different types of search. So you can search for really good, well-written, produced content, and then you can kind of like back search it. So you're like, okay, here's really good content. Who's the writer that made this content? And now I can like track down someone who might be good to contact to do a piece, you know, or you can just search straight for influencers, and their influencer search is pretty straightforward. Like, you put in subject areas or key topics or subject areas plus topics, that kind of a thing. And then it hones down. So like for me, I was looking for like people that, you know, covered events, but that who talked about Knots with like regularity. Right. So then it pulled up and you can rank them according to like what platform. But sometimes it'll just take you to their Instagram profile, and then it's kind of up to you to figure out how to contact them. But that's kind of cool. How I got in contact with some of the Parks and Cons guys and some of the Knott's Berry bloggers. Like there's one that's like, I don't remember, there's these influencers who's like their whole title is Knott's something, or they're not like they're basically like just blog about you guys. I don't remember.
Oh, maybe the Jambassadors or one of those.
Yeah, it's one of those. And
it's out there.
So like, those are like, you know, you just have to figure out how to contact them. So you don't really get the agency, you know, unless they are agency represented, then they like kick you to their agency. But
I'll have to check that out. Yeah. I always prefer working directly with the influencer. Anytime an influencer sends me to their agent or something, it's just more, you know, it's going to be more money and more hassle.
Yep.
I'll have to check out BuzzSumo because I've been very old school. I do manual searches. We use Sprout Social to pull up different content based on keywords. And that's how we find influencers that way. But a lot of it is just searching Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, mm-hmm. looking at what our competitors are doing, keyword searches, that type of thing. Usually we have an idea of like, okay, if we're working on, you know, Scary Farm, I have a pretty good idea of what our audience is. And so then I'll kind of look at okay, what type of influencer, not necessarily that they only cover haunted houses or horror, like we want some of those, but also like who's an influencer that our audience for Scary Farm, which is primarily teenagers and fairly young adults, you know, college age, maybe a little bit older than that. Who are they, you know, who are they following, and who would we be able to integrate that has a similar brand voice, you know, that's still family appropriate or at least willing to work mm-hmm. with brands. I guess the best way to say that would be brand friendly. Whereas yeah. something like the Boysenberry Festival, obviously we're looking for very different influencers, primarily food influencers and more of those like family bloggers with yeah. that. But you'll have to check out Bosumo. So
yeah.
To wrap up our influencer discussion, you found this great article from the Social Media Examiner about a very unique influencer. Why don't you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, I'd like to put this on here as the end here. So this comes from Social Media Examiner. And it comes actually, we're going to link to the blog post in the show notes, but it is a podcast. So you can listen to the podcast just from that page or, you know, subscribe or download it or whatever. But I also put notes in here for those of you that are on our email list. There's like notes in here that are kind of my main takeaways from this podcast. But it's a really interesting story for you guys to get more information on influencer marketing, because this, to sum it up, the guy is Josh Horton is the guy's name, and he started off, so he's always been in love with juggling. Okay, that's been like his thing forever, since he was like a child. And he went to school for business, and then he got, you know, kind of got a job in marketing, and he kind of had this like, when he was 25, he had this like epiphany where he's like, oh, well, I woke up and realized that I didn't have any paying gigs booked for juggling, but you know, and my whole day was just working at my marketing job. And so he kind of has this like quarter life crisis and quits his job in marketing and then just commits full time to become a professional juggler and to get, you know, gigs booked on a regular basis. So he goes down that road and he starts actually developing routines and kind of honing that, doing halftime shows and booking corporate events and all this stuff. So as he's getting into more like corporate events and that kind of stuff, he's thinking, well, I should apply some of my marketing knowledge to grow my follower base. So then he starts really getting into Instagram as his main platform. And then he kind of did a half step from Instagram into YouTube. And it's then... eventually, you know, he gets offered to do an influencer thing where it was some soccer company that was like, hey, we'll give you $150 to juggle soccer balls, you know, and put that on your Instagram. And so he was like, oh, $150 just to do like a, you know, 5-second clip of juggling soccer balls. Like, that's awesome. So that was a turning point for him. And he's gone more and more down as an influencer and creating branded content. And now he gets much more income from that than actually his, you know, professional gigs. And he's kind of now at a crossroads as to, you know, what he quits doing and what he keeps doing and that kind of thing. It's a really interesting story for you guys for a lot of reasons. The main is to understand the perspective of an influencer, you know, and to understand their kind of where they've come from and kind of hear it from him, from this influencer. And the next thing is there's a few really good tips in here about crafting your Instagram, and I've put them in the show notes, but he brings up some stuff about the thumbnails and about kind of like priming your followers to really interact with something, because the way that the Instagram and everything measures it is based on how many people interact with it when it first comes out. And then, you know, that's how it ranks higher in the discovery section, and he's made it, you know, onto kind of like the ad Instagram page a few times, so you know he's had a good success with this. So he talks about that. He also talks about his YouTube strategy versus his Instagram strategy, which is also a very good takeaway for you guys to understand, to really understand how these are different, and even hear it from an influencer's perspective, right? For where he's like, look, on my Instagram, this is what I focus on. And on my YouTube, I focus on this longer form type of content to show them my personality. And these are the types of things that I do to get the point of my personality across to them. And this is all critical because you as a brand, you know, whenever we do influencer partnerships, we have to meet them halfway. You know, you have to understand, you know, say if I'm going to do an Instagram thing with him, I understand what he's trying to do with his Instagram. But if I want to do a YouTube thing with him, I need to understand what his purpose is behind his Instagram, behind his YouTube, what the strategy is, and how, you know, we can meld those two together. So it's great for these. And the last thing that's really awesome about this interview is he mentioned specific examples of what brands have paid him to do, which is great because it gives you guys more concrete examples beyond what Brad and I have given you. He talks about his contract with the cruise ship, and he's talked about his contracts with larger brands and smaller brands, and kind of it's a good like 5-7 minute thing towards the middle, like 3/4 mark of the interview about specific examples. So some really good takeaways for you guys about that, about hearing it from kind of the mouth of the influencer directly in such an interesting field, especially an influencer that has kind of like a marketing background. So he's able to kind of give you both sides of it, you know, the marketing side and also the passionate side where he's just trying to break world records in juggling, but he's also trying to he's also a marketer. So it's a very good interview. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, it's a very earnest perspective. You know, he didn't one day, you know, wake up and go, how am I going to become an influencer? He approached it of, hey, I love juggling. How can I do more of that and be mm-hmm. able to support myself doing it. Those are always the best influencers to work with, the ones who are actually passionate about it. Mm-hmm. Because if they're just chasing money, they probably are not going to be the best ones to work with and to represent your brand. They're probably going to be really expensive too.
Yep, exactly.
This is a great conversation. I'm excited now. I'm excited to check out BuzzSumo and continue our work with influencer marketing. And it's one of those, like every part of digital marketing, ever changing. But hopefully if the audience has any questions, where can they send us those questions and maybe we can feature them on the show.
Well, I recommend that you all head over to marketingyouratraction.com and sign up there for our email list, which gives you the expanded show notes. You'll get our notification for each new episode, but you also get expanded show notes rather than just what appears in the podcast description. And you get our emails are in there, so you can shoot us, Brad or I, an email or just respond to our weekly blasts and we'll get your questions and bring them here on the show.
Awesome. And since we're talking about social media influencers, I'll plug my Twitter. So maybe one day I can join you, Philip, as a social media influencer. You can follow me at Brad, and then my super complicated last name, Jashinsky, it's Brad, B-R-A-D, at J-A-S-H-I-N-S-K-Y on Twitter. Phil, what's your Twitter handle?
I don't even know, actually.
Philip doesn't even Twitter.
I don't even Twitter. I have one. Yeah, I mean, if you tweeted me, I probably, it's probably better just to get me on Facebook or email, because if you tweet me, it might take me a while to even realize I can tweet it at.
Yeah, just go to marketingyouratraction.com.
Yeah.
Contact us that way. And then follow me on Twitter. So that wraps the talk show for this week. Thanks, Philip. We'll talk to everyone next week. Have a great week.
Bye, everyone.